to an episode of Crippled by Culture, where we talk about everything in life and relate it to the disabled and chronically ill community. My name is Sean Gold, and I'm an author, advocate, and nonverbal public speaker for the disabled community. To provide a quick visual description for accessibility, I'm a Black man with a white tracheostomy breathing tube in my neck, and I'm wearing a Black shirt. The person off camera is who you hear speaking for me. This video is of a Zoom call with me and the other person talking for me off camera, and my guest is in the other box next to it. Today, I would like to thank Adam Ross for being my voice in this episode. In this episode, we are talking about the intersections of disability, non-disabled family members, and finding disabled role models.
Before we get any further into the interview, I want to give a shout out to our partnering nonprofit festival for the series, Festability. As the media director, I help organize a wonderful event in St. Louis at the Missouri History Museum. We have so many activities and vendors set up all over with an amazing headliner for our main stage each year. It is the best event in St. Louis to celebrate your disability unapologetically while celebrating the Americans with Disabilities Act. Make sure you come out if you're nearby. Check out the link in the description to learn more. Thank you, Festability, for sponsoring the series. Now, back to the show.
Now, let's get to today's amazing guest. Kelly Coleman is a feature film development executive turned author whose book, Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child, Your Guide to the Systems, Services, and Supports, which comes out March 12, 2024. It stems from her own experience. Her book gives practical templates, outlines, and worksheets for how to navigate all the paperwork and red tape that can come with getting your child the supports they need. It includes interviews with over 40 top disability experts. Kelly serves on committees for Children's Hospital Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Unified School District, and service dog organization Canine Companions. Kelly, thank you for being here today. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me, Sean. I'm excited for us to connect.
Yes, I'm excited to get into this conversation with you and to connect, and we're going to have a good time. And would you mind giving a visual description of yourself, please?
My pleasure. My name is Kelly Coleman. I am a white woman with long, mostly bright pink hair, and I have glasses, pink lipstick, a gray sweater, and my background is lavender wallpaper with dark brown graphics of animals and musical instruments.
I appreciate that. And first, do you identify with having a disability or chronic illness yourself?
I do not identify as disabled.
Okay. We can definitely talk about your child's disability if you're open to it. I'm excited to have an interview from a parent's perspective.
Thank you. And as I had mentioned when you first reached out to the Diversability Leadership Collective, which everyone should check out, it's wonderful, about your podcast, I was hesitant to even respond because there's such a tricky balance between non-disabled people serving the disability community in an authentic and actually helpful way and not taking up space where disabled people should be the leaders and be the voice and taking up space. So that's always a balance. And where I am coming from is I am a writer, I am an author, and first and foremost, I'm a mom. I have two amazing boys, one of whom is also named Sean, and one is disabled, one is not. And my book stems from my decade of experience figuring out all of the systems and the stuff and the paperwork and the red tape and how to actually get equipment, navigate your insurance company, financial plan, do all of the really boring stuff that nobody wants to do, but you got to do it and nobody tells you how to do it. And that's where I am coming from. Anytime I'm sharing about my son's disability and about either of my children, I have already discussed in advance and have made sure that I'm discussing with their consent. I think parents of any children can easily fall into not discussing and getting consent and having real conversations with their children about what they're talking about, which is icky for so many reasons. So thank you for asking. We're very comfortable discussing. My younger son, his name is Aaron, and he's 10 years old, and he has multiple disabilities, including a yet undiagnosed genetic syndrome. We've done every test science has available up through full genome sequencing through the Undiagnosed Diseases Network. And we have yet to pinpoint the gene, but myself and my husband and our team believes there's absolutely a genetic component that is the thing that's pushing the dominoes down. And within the undiagnosed genetic syndrome, which is a rare disease, he has been diagnosed with epilepsy, cortical vision impairment, microcephaly, autism, sensory processing challenges. He has a feeding tube. He's excessively handsome, which is probably the most important part. And he is mobile. He is able to walk, though he has an atypical gait and stamina and all the things. But he's very mobile, often never stops moving. And our goal for the day might be to sit still for 30 seconds. And that's not an exaggeration. He communicates, as I was saying to Sean before our interview, I'm so excited to talk to Sean because any opportunity I can take to have conversations and real dialogue with non-verbal communicators is really exciting. My son has vocalizations and sounds that he makes that many would not recognize as words, but those of us who know him recognize those as words. He has use of his hands, but he can have a lot of dexterity and fine motor challenges. So he does some sign language. He's able to point, and his pointing has come in very handy as we've really been diving into his alternative augmentative communication device, otherwise known as AAC, or his talker, or his iPad, or the, hey, mom, get me that thing over there. That he is simultaneously using a program that is identifying pictures. It says the words out loud, and on his own has been putting multiple word sentences together. And I could talk about that all day. It's amazing. Even when he says, mom, go away. Great. Let's do that. I will go away. And so we're really excited that that journey is going well. And at the same time, are really working on his letter identification and identifying the sounds and the letters together, because I believe that he is a kid who will increase his vocalizations in whatever form that takes, words and or otherwise, but also will be a fluent speller and will likely also continue to use the AAC program with the picture devices, because for him that is just coming so fast in a way that's really exciting. And while not the overarching topic of our discussion, so important, and Sean, I'm sure you say this all the time, any nonverbal communicators need access to every single communication option that society has available. Schools need to give that, regional centers, social services, whoever is getting that to them, don't decide they can't do this before they have an opportunity. And that opportunity can take months or years, and it doesn't matter. This is a lesson I learned the hard way, and I've made the mistake. And my son got this device much too late in his life, in my opinion, because I was ignorant as to what he needed. But as I'm learning, It is thrilling to watch your child, who you always knew was brilliant, tell you, I want different music, or bed good when he's tired. And when he says, want dad hug, which he said the other day, doesn't get much better than that.
Love that. I love that. And yeah, you made so many good points. And firstly, thank you for, you know, bringing forward that point that it's so important for anyone discussing another person's disability. It's so important to have that consent, and children absolutely deserve that. They have a right to that. And so thank you for highlighting that. And also, with the access to communication tools, right? It's crucial. It's so important. It's a human right, really, you know? So thank you. Thank you for that. And yeah, we love hearing about the kids, and so thank you. And I agree. And I also will say that communication devices are not necessarily for everybody, but hopefully he advances to needing more than a communication device.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I so appreciate all of that. And then to highlight what you just said of communication is a human right. And some people are part-time device users and part-time speakers. Some people are not interested in using the device, or where they are, that's just not what they're ready for. And you're absolutely right, that's okay. But if every parent, educator, healthcare provider, social service worker started every single conversation with the presumption and the knowledge that communication is a human right, what a different place we would all be in. If we said every single child, adult, human that comes across our path deserves to communicate to their fullest desire, that's exciting.
And since you mentioned you don't identify as disabled, are you involved or connected with the disabled community in any other ways than, I mean, obviously your children are a very important connection to you as a parent. Can you talk about your connection to the disabled community in general?
Sure thing. So my connection with the disability community, you know, of course, everyone knows disabled people in their lives. I was not as intimately connected to it until I had a son who was disabled, and then I was headfirst into it. And a woman named Judy Mark, who runs a great organization called Disability Voices United, which is a self-advocacy organization run by disabled people, self-advocates, and Judy had started this. And she and I had a great conversation the other day where she just nailed this. As she said, in the very beginning, I got all of my best information from other parents, because you have a baby and you have a toddler, and that's where all parents get it. But as my son, who her son is now an adult, as my son got older, all of my best information comes from disabled people. Not from the guy at the grocery store who says, oh, you should take this vitamin and your son will be cured. Well, it's genetics. Genetics can't be cured. Not from the well-meaning teacher, not from a bunch of parents online, not even from your best friends, because they don't know the lived experience. And I'm on committees for organizations, you know, whether it's Children's Hospital or Canine Companions, that serve disabled people and have disabled people involved, of course. But whether it's being a member of organizations like the Diversability Leadership Collective, or just taking the opportunity to get to know disabled people, it's super weird if I go up to someone just at the market or at the park and say, hey, you're disabled, can we be buddies? No, that's not how being a human works. But when your eyes are open, opportunities present themselves all the time. And you are talking to people and having people in your lives that become your friends. And through writing my book, Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child, Your Guide to the Essential Systems, Services, and Supports, all boring stuff. Here's how to actually do it. I just found out yesterday it's available for pre-order on Amazon. And so that's very exciting. I made so many incredible connections with disabled parents of disabled children and with disabled experts in their fields as I was writing this. And it has been remarkable over the last year to have these conversations, because when it's not just, hey, what kind of latte are you getting? But instead, it's, you are an expert and I'm looking for your expertise, whether it's on disability justice or whether it's on how to figure out my insurance company, which is awful always. Talking to experts and really digging into the ins and outs of all of this stuff, then also, you know, the personal things come up, and having actual real life disabled humans in your life is so important. If you are a non-disabled parent raising a disabled child, because I don't know his lived experience. And it's exciting for, he's 10. He doesn't express that he cares about talking about identity. He'd rather talk about airplanes. He'd rather swim, but he's 10. But for him to just see, you know what, we're going to go hang out with a group of adults and they have service dogs. He's excited about the service dogs, but it's planting those seeds of, there are disabled people in our lives and in our community, and that's just how the world works. And for me, it's so important for both of my children to be around people who aren't like them, but also people who are like them. And for them to grow up, for both of my children to grow up with just this understanding that, well, obviously disabled people are part of the fabric of everything, because that's how the world works. And when I was growing up, that wasn't the message. The message was, don't stare, don't look, don't talk to that person, just pretend like they're not there. And that's devastating. And like, having grown up with that, and I think so many people of my age and generation did, and then having a child who is disabled and identifies as disabled, totally took us off guard. And I think for many parents, we've been programmed our whole lives to think, oh, that's just horrible. No, it's just life. That's just a thing. And there are things that can be harder. There are things that are not harder at all. But unfortunately, and myself included, so many parents come into the disability world from a place of total ignorance as to reality. And so we just make stuff up and we make ourselves bananas because we think this is going to be terrible. But the reality it is, you don't know. And there's plenty of medical stuff that I wish that my son and others didn't have to deal with. But his personality and the way he communicates and experiences joy in the world every day, I wouldn't take that away from him. And man, I wish I'd known that when he was born and when we started down this path, because I made things so much harder on myself than I needed to, because I was ignorant of so much and I just felt inadequate. And I'm like, fill that hole, what can we do? And you lose so much energy and stress and tears and frustration over all of your anxious thoughts that are based on nothing. And I wish I had realized then that it was actually based on absolutely nothing. And like everyone in my family, we are quirky and we are weird and we do our own things, disabled or not. Like, it's just us. And I really wish, and that's a big reason why I wrote this book, is disability isn't necessarily the scary thing. Being on hold with Medi-Cal and knowing that the customer service line might hang up on you, that's scary because you don't have that time. And if we can look at all of this, you know, financial planning, oh my gosh, and how do I figure out what social services are available, or how do I come up with a list of questions to take to a specialist when I don't know anything about neuro-ophthalmology? What? I forget how many H's are in the word ophthalmology. I don't know. But this book, I feel like, attacks ableism by saying, this is the hard stuff. All of these systems that nobody knows. And if you can't figure this out, your child is not going to get what they need. And the horrible reality that because I am an English-speaking, middle-class, white woman, my kid gets more. He doesn't get anything he doesn't need. He doesn't get anything he doesn't deserve. But his friends' parents have had these conversations with me saying, I speak a few languages, but my English isn't perfect. I'm working these jobs. They look at me and they discount me because I am a Black woman and they're a room full of old white men. So you know what? I get written off and my kid doesn't get as much. And this book is really that foundation of how can we even the playing field from the beginning of giving every single person the same foundation and the same information so that they can ask the questions that get their child what they need. Your child might not need feeding therapy. My child needs feeding therapy. Your child might not need a device. Mine needs a device. Yours might not need a service dog. Mine needs a service dog. It doesn't matter what the needs are. What matters is having a foundation of how, what is available, how to figure that out, what to ask the person once you finally get them on hold after you're ready to pull your hair out because you've been sitting there forever, what to ask that person, how to follow up, and just how to do the awful stuff better because nobody wants to do paperwork. And that is a huge part of my life. And I am a writer by trade, and this is my first nonfiction anything. So I'm coming at it as a writer with stories and letters from other parents and interviews with these experts who are amazing, so that it is digestible and it's not just big blocks of here's 18 pages on disability justice. Nope, here's some questions and how to contact your officials and here's the things. Because nobody has time for that and nobody has time for a boring book. So this is not a boring book, even though it sounds like the most boring thing you could read. I promise you it is not.
Yes. And to your point, you know, things are in our societies are built in such a way that it is so difficult, right, to jump those hurdles and to find all of those resources. So for parents of disabled and chronically ill children to have, you know, as many tools in their toolboxes as they can possibly get their hands on. Absolutely. So important. So thank you for, yes, thank you for writing it. Because we know somebody.
Yeah.
People are going to need it. Right. And resources like it. And I also appreciate that you connect your children with the disabled community. You know, it's so important for your son and other disabled kids to have examples, you know, and also looking away is more harmful than staring.
Thank you.
And it continues that pattern of segregation by ability. And segregation has not completely ended, especially in schools, in part because of that what you mentioned.
Absolutely. And oh, continue.
Go ahead. Oh, no, please.
Oh, so I love that you brought up the importance of identifying as a member of the disability community. I've had so many conversations about language as I've been writing this book. As a non-disabled person, I'm sure there will be plenty of people who say, I shouldn't write this, I'm not disabled, but you know what? I'm real good at paperwork, so there you go. I think anyone who's not familiar with Rebecca Coakley, she is a remarkable disability justice warrior, and incredibly articulate. And if you Google her, pull her up on podcasts, everything you listen to by her really pinpoints so much of what we all need to hear. And she speaks so articulately about the importance of being a part of and having pride in that disability community and disability as an identity. And I've discussed with so many people, do you say disabled child? Do you say child who is disabled? And is it the person first language? Is it the identity first language? And I believe the reality is it would be great if each person could communicate to the world how they would like to be identified. The reality is, even within the title of my book, Parenting a Disabled Child, was a conscious choice that I really went back and forth on. And because disabled child is the reason that this book exists, not child with a disability, because disability is central to who my son is, to his identity, and to how he exists within the world, that is how he identifies. So many people who identify as autistic say, I am autistic, I am an autistic person, not I am a person with autism, because that, to many people with whom I have spoken, said that sort of feels like, oh, but maybe we can fix that thing. Nope, nothing to fix. Not what we do. People aren't broken. So saying my son is a disabled person is, for me, has become no different than saying my son is an artistic person. My son is a creative person, an enthusiastic person. It is language that objectively describes who he is. And if he chooses to change how he identifies, and if he's like, Mom, I'm a person with a disability, and I want them to see me as a person first, then you know what? I will be the first person to jump on that bandwagon. But for us, saying he is a disabled person, in my mind, really speaks to that sense of community. And I want him to always be proud that he is a member of that community, and to feel like that is a place where he has identity and community and comfort and familiarity. And man, I wish I had that growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. And it, you're right. It all depends on each person to self-determine that, to self-identify that, and then to communicate that as they see fit, right? And I personally, like, I definitely use person with a disability. But also to your point about autistic identity and autistic people and that parallel with disabled identity, right? Obviously, the overlap. And How there's this sort of underlying suggestion that for many people who are autistic, have said this feels like it's, you're trying, it's trying to, separate it from my person as like a separate thing. And then once it's a separate thing, then it can be fixed, then it can be changed, or then it can be, suppressed, or what have you, right? Which is a violation. And the whole idea of a cure is really just a way for eugenics, right? For those eugenics, the values of eugenics to take place and to continue to harm people.
And the word that you used, suppress, I think is a very interesting one when we are talking about disability, and especially parents considering their children who are also disabled. Is our goal to suppress their disability to the maximum extent, or is our goal to make them the best human they can possibly be? And oftentimes, and boy, I know this from my own experience, that means us putting our egos or preconceived notions aside and saying, I am not trying to suppress a thing about my child. I have a kid who goes to the grocery store, he runs over to the lettuce and he dances. And he dances and he sees someone and he says hello and he claps and he applauds them arriving at the lettuces. There are people or therapies who would do their best to suppress that because that is not typical behavior. But man, it's fun. And am I trying to suppress who he is in order to make him fit into everyone else's mold? Or am I saying, you know what? Do you want to dance at the lettuce? Do you also want to dance over by the cheese? Because I want to dance by the cheese. And how can we put ourselves aside as much as possible as non-disabled people, or even as someone who doesn't share our child's disability? Because there are also plenty of disabled parents whose ch children have a different disabled identity. How do we put our own notions aside and say, I'm gonna try stepping into your world to the extent I'm able. And let's do this, but let's do this your way is exciting to figure out, like, what is my kid's way with my child who is not disabled? I'm along for the ride in his world. Why would I treat my disabled child any differently and not be along for the ride for all of his interests? And if he wants to stand outside and watch airplanes for half an hour, why is that any less legitimate than my other son who wants to practice guitar for half an hour? Nope, it's your thing. Let's do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. And, we've been discussing disability, so many things about disability. What is your personal definition after, up to this point, right, with all of the disabled people that you've had contact with and all the things that you've been able to learn over time? How do you define disability?
I think how one defines disability, certainly as a disabled person, I think you need to tell the world and keep having this discussion because I think disabled people need to be the ones answering that question more than anything else. I tend to really wrap my head around the definition as it's set forth in the Americans with Disabilities Act because, well, not recalling the exact language, it talks about any physical or cognitive impairment or condition, I don't remember the word they use, that impacts activities of life, daily living. I need to memorize this because it's good. And the fact that I don't have it memorized shows you I need to do more homework, which I will be doing for the rest of my life. I like that the Americans with Disabilities Act doesn't talk about who is quote unquote disabled enough. It doesn't talk, it also speaks to perceived disability. If someone has, for example, a birthmark on their face that others might perceive as a disability, they are still protected within the Americans with Disabilities Act, even though they are not themselves disabled. I like that it casts a wide net. So I try very hard within considering that to also not assume that someone identifies as disabled based on my meeting them, talking to them, glancing at them, whatever it is. There are many people with invisible disabilities that I wouldn't know from speaking to them. There are people that I might presume are disabled, and I would be wrong because they're not. So I think, you know, talking back to language, person first, when you are standing in front of a human, and if someone is identifying themselves as a disabled, my son is visibly disabled. And by that, I mean, you can look at him and it is quite safe to make the assumption that he is disabled because he appears to be disabled. But to really be careful about jumping to, in any realm, about jumping to conclusions about other humans, because that gets real messy real fast.
Right. Yeah, real fast. And you make such a good point. And it brings us back to that self-determination thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
For disabled and chronically ill people, for people with disabilities, to, you know, have that human right honored, for us to be able to define for ourselves what those things mean, mm-hmm. so important. Because historically, of course, it has been non-disabled people, and you know, particularly you know, government entities that have been the definers of what these things mean. So yeah, really, really good points.
Absolutely.
And yeah.
And to your point of non-disabled people and government entities being the ones who are doling out the wisdom and the services and the thoughts and the things, it is worthwhile anytime you are interacting with insurance companies, governments, schools, all of the things. I often ask if they have disabled employees, if they have disabled supervisors, if the decision makers are themselves disabled. Usually the answer is a resounding no, but if we asked everyone that at every IEP meeting, of, you know, there are higher ups in, you know, the mediation department who are going to be making the decisions, out of curiosity, do any of those people identify as disabled? And it's a resounding no over and over. And, you know, my great hope with my book and my kids and beyond is that we can empower more disabled leaders, because I guarantee if the Medicare system was run by disabled people, it would be run very differently. And if the IEP system was run by disabled people, it would be very, very different. And there could be a real conversation about self-determination within these systems, about full communication within these systems, and two parents raising disabled children. If your kid grows up to be in charge of Medi-Cal, would be awesome. So if you could just raise your kid to run the healthcare system, thank you. That would be great.
Yes. Yeah, we need that. We need that for disabled people, and chronically ill people and people with disability to be in those rooms and to have that power, you know, within institutions to be able to say, okay, so this is what I think as a disabled person.
Mm-hmm.
This is the information that I'm getting from my community and the people who I have access to, you know, that's so important.
Yes. And in addition to that, oh, sorry, did I cut you off?
Oh, no,
oh,
please.
Okay. I'm so excited. I'm just still going. In addition to that, and I, for the book, one of my interviews was rather remarkably, one of Judy Heumann's last interviews. And we talked so much about, and we were able to sit down in person and talked so much about the need for disabled leaders in all places and in all areas. And it is essential to have disabled people running these systems and leading the conversations about disability. Also, we need to have disabled people who are making the movies, who are running the corporations, who are senators, who are our doctors. If we have an awareness in the world of how often we genuinely see disabled leaders, we're looking at Tammy Duckworth a lot and saying, all right, you're in government, you got this, but where is everyone? And yes, people are out there and there are entrepreneurs and there are leaders, but we need more of that everywhere so that disability becomes a part of the community that is just a natural part of everyday life, and where it is not a big deal that, hey, I'm feeding my kid with his feeding tube. Oh yeah, you've seen 18 other people with feeding tubes. That's not a big deal. Let's get to that point when there are feeding tubes in government meetings, when there are trachs at the, you know, people have trachs at the reception desk or in the decision-making tables in the boardroom, like wherever that is. The more that we can see that, the more people with invisible disabilities feel safe to identify themselves as someone who processes things differently or has this disability, then I think more people would realize disabled people are everywhere. That's life. And we need that leadership. We're getting there, but we need that.
Yeah, and you're right. Disabled people, we are, you know, we're part of humanity. It's it's very human to be disabled.
Yes.
Yeah. And what is something that you have learned, something maybe that we haven't gotten to talk about just yet, that sticks with you on a daily basis, that you've learned from the disability community or a specific disabled person?
Oh gosh, how long do you have? There is so much that I have learned from the disability community. One thing that first comes to mind, because it touches on everything, Emily Liddell, who wrote a fantastic book called Demystifying Disability. She also has a podcast, and she is just a powerhouse of so many things. In my own conversations with her for the book and in her speaking and in her own book, she talks about how being an ally and being a part of the disability community, like, this is not a destination that you reach and you're like, okay, you know what? I read these six books and I listened to this podcast and I'm friends who identify as this. And like, I've checked the boxes. Nope, not a thing. I am enthusiastic to be a genuine ally, to step aside when I can and to support when I can and to do the things. And I really want to get it right. I'm going to get it wrong sometimes. I'm going to learn and I'm going to do better. And this journey for me will always be learning and always be doing better. And for me, that reaches into every aspect of when I am writing and when I am working on the book of what am I learning, and not just like checking boxes, but really hearing and having confidence enough in myself to say, I thought this, I learned better information, and my thoughts on that topic have evolved. I was wrong. I'm learning, and here's my thought now. That being an ally, and again, back to Emily Ladau, being an ally is not a destination. It is constant and continued action. Having a child who is disabled has opened my eyes to so much and to so many conversations with really cool people. And for any parent, I hope that's what your children do for you, is open your eyes to opportunities to say, hey, I thought this before and I think this now. We should all be so lucky as to say, I have learned and I have evolved and I'm on a path. I'm never going to reach a destination, but you know what? I am learning from humans who lived an experience. And boy, that's better than just making presumptions, which we're always going to get wrong.
I love how you specifically use the word evolve instead of change. There's such a difference to me, and I don't think people understand that difference all the time, but it's so important. But I would love to talk more about your life as a parent raising a disabled child. Have you, well, I mean, we're into it. We are into it. But have you, can you talk about any times maybe that you have faced discrimination or your kids have faced discrimination in schools because of your child's disability?
I think we definitely have examples. The overarching thing I will say about the discrimination we have experienced thus far, my children are, older one is 11, my younger who is disabled is 10. I have been shocked at how infrequently we've experienced discrimination or even staring. It is surprising and gives me hope for the world. The most concrete example of discrimination that comes to mind is the ever fun IEP process. For people who aren't familiar with IEPs, an IEP stands for Individualized Education Plan, and that is the plan put together for students with disabilities so that they can receive what they're entitled to under federal law, which is a free and appropriate public education, which is what federal law spells out. So the IEP process involves lots of meetings, lots of paperwork, lots of talking to people, ideally people who are on your team all the time and who know your child. Well, sometimes other people just come in from the district, and ours tend to be myself, my husband, one of our therapy supervisors, and about a dozen people from the school district in a big room that's always freezing. I don't know if everyone else's IEP meetings are always really cold, but ours are always freezing. So bring a sweater. Bunch of people sitting across the room from you, and essentially the less skilled people, which unfortunately that happens often, the less skilled people are telling you, here's all the ways your child is falling short. And it feels like this exercise in just being defeated over and over, rather than the people who got it right, who first talk about, your kid's awesome, let's talk about that. And let's talk about all of the ways that we can help your child to succeed at the rate of their peers. Because that's the name of the game for all children, is success at the rate of their peers, to the greatest of their ability. Because my child has cognitive needs, academic needs, physical needs, medical needs, there are a whole lot of people in the room. And one time we were presented the, so everybody discusses and has all the things and talks about the goals in this meetings. And then the people from the school district make an offer of FAPE, free and appropriate education, to public education, to the parents, and don't ever accept it in the room. Always go home and think about it, even if you know it's right, and then come back. Always need to read it. So the district people make their offer. And one year, the district person made the offer, and it included his academic placement and supports and related services and all of the things, with no plan for my child to eat during the school day. My child is able to drink water from a cup, and other than that, is 100% G-tube fed. And G-tube is a feeding tube in the stomach, for those who aren't familiar with that. And they're awesome. It sounds scary if you've never seen one, but they're great. They made an offer that did not include any way for my child to eat during the school day. And they said, closed it, put their hands on the table and said, that's our offer. And I said, but what about feeding him? And the woman looked at me in the eye and she said, that's not part of our offer. As a parent, or as any person, can you imagine the school district saying, we are offering, as we're legally obligated to do, for your child to attend school, and your child cannot eat from the moment they get there until the moment they leave? Yes, everybody else there will have snack time. There's breakfast in the classroom. There is lunchtime for everybody, but your child, they can't eat. And not only on a human level is that awful discrimination, and how can you look someone in the eye and say that? But that is unquestionably discriminating against my son based on his disability. And my response when she said, that's not part of our offer, I looked at her and I said, then why are we here? Unfortunately, in IEP meetings, things like this happen all the time. Parents are often unaware of their rights. They're unaware of their child's rights. And accommodations and plans and offers and everything put in writing often are not made. Man, I wish all parents had my book. Somebody should write a book about this. Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child. We need to know what our children's rights are. And if someone tells you that your child eating during the school day is not part of the school district's offer, that is incredible discrimination. And I am certain no one would ever tell my non-disabled son that he is allowed to attend school, but is not ever allowed to or able to eat. That stinks, huh?
Absolutely disgusting that they would actually say that, but to even think it. Mm-hmm. Just, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, we fought that, and my child has an IEP in place that provides a free and appropriate education that includes food.
Oh, good, good. Yes, because I was going to say, did you raise hell? Please say yes.
I'm pleased to report I've become very good at raising a lot of hell. And what I tell parents over and over going into IEP meetings and also into many doctor's appointments and social services meetings is keep in mind be respectful, be reasonable, and be right. Be respectful. Don't yell and scream and like do all the things. You need to listen. You need to be a part of the process. You need to be reasonable. Don't ask for things like, I'm not going to ask for my child to learn to snowboard at school because that's not reasonable. That'd be awesome, by the way, but also we live somewhere that doesn't snow, so not really useful. Know what the outcomes can be from any meeting that you are in, and don't over ask because that just wastes everybody's time, but know what is reasonable for your child and what is available. And be right. And so many people say, I can't be right. I don't know how to do this. I don't know what these systems are. And that's where people get tripped up. Because my kid is 10 years old. We've had, probably 15 IEP meetings by now. And in every meeting, I stop people and I say, pardon me, I don't know what that acronym is. Could you please explain that? What you just said, could you say that back to me again so that I am clear? Ask questions. You are never going to know everything about gastroenterology or about services and supports available through your school district, about disability justice and law and rights. You are never going to know all of this ever. But the way that you can be right is having the wherewithal and the confidence, and it can be hard sometimes, even for me, and I've done this a lot, to say, wait, I want to be an equal member of the team in the room. I don't understand right now. Please explain to me until I understand, because I cannot serve my child if I don't understand. And some people fear that will put them in a weaker position, saying they don't understand. I would argue, and I have seen, that puts you in a stronger position because it shows the people on the other side of the table that you are all in, that you are going to ask every question, and that you are going to get to the bottom of what your child needs. So being right doesn't mean you know everything. Being right means you don't move forward until the people who you are working with, the systems you have working with, until you have gotten the information that you need in order to make the best decisions. So ask every question you need to ask and hold your head high, because that is your right, is to understand all of this. And it's awful. This is the paperwork and the meetings and the phone calls. It's so horrible. But right. Hang in there.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that with our audience, because, you know, it can be, as you know from experience, it can be so overwhelming and disorienting, trying to figure everything out. And you don't know what's going on, and it feels like a pressurized situation, you know? And so, yeah, asking the questions. Yeah, absolutely. Because they do have a responsibility to answer those questions.
Yes. Yes, they do. And I always know that if I think I am not getting straight answers from the person or people in the room, especially with IEP meetings, I always know who I can go to above them to ask the same questions. Sometimes I do, just to make sure I'm getting the same answers. We are incredibly fortunate that my son is now at a public school that he's been at for a number of years, where our IEP team is consistently productive and collaborative, and I believe has his best interests at heart. Took us a while to get there, but always know what your other options are, because IEP meetings are notorious for opportunities to lie to parents to end the meeting sooner and give the kid less, because then we spend less money. And I am a big believer in public education. I'm a believer in appropriate education for all children, but are you going to get lied to? Yep, you sure are. It's going to happen. Don't get too upset when it is. It's not just you. As I was saying, with parents thinking about going into a meeting with your specialist or IEP meeting of how can you be respectful, how can you be reasonable, and how can you be right? Know what you are able to get out of this interaction and ask those questions so that you can be informed. You don't have to know everything. You will never know all of this. I have reached a point where I'm quite good at much of this. My son, 10 years ago today, he was 2 months old. I knew nothing. I had no idea about any of this. These incredible disabled leaders who I'm quoting, I didn't know who they were. I didn't understand the work that had been done, the history. I didn't know the first thing about any of this. I was ignorant. I was scared because I felt totally inadequate to raise this child. And that is how parents feel at the beginning of this. And that's where so much of this fear and frankly ableism comes from so early, and from parents of, I have this feeling, which for me, I finally was able to name that feeling, and it was total inadequacy. I wasn't scared. Oh, I'm going to cry. Here I go. I wasn't scared of this amazing baby with this really cool hair. I was so scared that I can't do this. And when parents are given a diagnosis, it is often so sloppily and awkwardly and uncomfortably delivered in a way that is heartbreaking or appalling or confusing or whatever. Parents are essentially told to go home, Google, and cry. We still don't have a diagnosis, so I don't have the devastating diagnosis story that so many do. But I have a lot of go home, Google, and cry. We're figuring this out. Well, decade in, we still haven't figured it out. I wish I had had this book a decade ago when my son was, try, here I go, when he was 2 months old. And I didn't know how to do any of this. My fear wasn't about capital D disability. My fear was, I don't know anything. And where do I even begin? And when families first start thinking about future planning and financial planning for a child who will need lifetime support, and for children who have extensive care needs. And by the way, I'm saying children because mine are young and children. And I greatly hope that when they're grown-ups, if I'm just referring to them, especially my disabled son, as children, I hope people will correct me, because disabled adults are not children. I just didn't know anything. And it has, I am good at organizing and paperwork, and boy, that's a boring superpower, but I can get out a label maker and I can paint the town. And this has been all encompassing for me to figure out. Not my son. He's awesome. I talk about him all day. We can blow bubbles. He's the mayor of the grocery store. He loves school. Like, he's awesome. It wasn't figuring out him. It was figuring out the special needs trust and the extensive insurance needs and social services and breaking through that and the wait list and the phone calls and who to talk to. And Vanessa's going to help me, but Sylvia is not going to help me. The things that people say to you that are just awful and ignorant and all of the things coming at you. When you don't know anything, okay, I'm going to cry again, and all you want to do is just love this kid. And I'm going to cry again. Sean, you're making me cry. Don't do this. We all know how to love our kids, but nobody knows how to do all this crappy maze of red tape and paperwork. And it breaks my heart that if I had had this book, if I had known this stuff, if I had had this foundation 10 years ago today when he was 2 months old, would he be further along in his journey? Yes. Would I? I've wasted so much money. I have wasted so much time and gobs and gobs and gobs of stress. I can't take that all away for everybody. But I can get you closer to the finish line when you're not wasting the time and money and stress. It's not that hard once you know how to do it, but no one is going to tell you how to do it. Every parent who is holding this baby and just wants to like go and like walk the dog in their park and hold the baby, nobody's going to tell you how to do any of this. And you have to figure it out while you're not sleeping, while you're taking care of a kid, you know, a baby or a toddler, or a teenager, whatever. We are all reinventing the exact same wheels. Every single parent has to jump through the exact same hoops across so many different disabilities. I am certain anyone who is listening to this or watching this, their child or themselves, they do not have the same disability as my son. He might literally be the only person in the world with his particular genetic syndrome, perhaps the only person ever. He doesn't have the same thing, but we have the same hurdles and hoops. And I have reinvented all of these wheels that other people have already figured out. And this book is my attempt to say, here are all these wheels you don't have to reinvent. Just go love your child. Because that's the part that isn't scary. And Sean, you make me cry. That's when it is the least scary, is when you can just hang out and you just love your child. And I'll watch my language, crappy paperwork stuff is awful and it's hard and it's terrible, but there are so many amazing resources out there. And man, I wish I could have saved all that time and money, but hopefully moving forward, I will continue to evolve and to do better.
I love that so much. And, you know, it is so good to know that that there are resources available, right? Because they don't make these things the most easy to find, right? Yeah. And that's clearly an understatement by far, of course. But yes, oh, by the way, please feel free to use any profanity. We don't filter here.
My kids aren't going to watch this for a while. It's okay.
Yes. But we appreciate you. And, you know, like you said, it has been so much work, so much stress, so much anxiety, all of these things that you and your family have had to put into trying to navigate this fucked up ableist and all the other system, right?
I'm going to quote you on that. Yes.
Yes. Yes. But it is good to hear these cases where there are, you know, there are ways to navigate if we have that crucial information. And to your point about, you know, we're all kind of against the same hurdles, but the disability is dynamic, is so different between people. That's so true because disability shows up in an infinite number of ways, right? So people can even have the same diagnosis, and their disabilities or chronic illnesses might show up in a different way. And so I love the way that you framed that.
And exactly what you just said is yet another reason why it is so important for parents to immerse themselves in the disability community. And by immerse themselves, I don't mean go in there just like, hey, here I am, and I'm going to talk about stuff. You can talk. There's a place for like, pipe down. The thing that people can do right now, simultaneously, while they are listening to this, is follow disabled leaders on social media. There are influencers, there are regular people, there are parents, there are lawyers, there are doctors, there are teachers, nurses. Like, there are so many people. If you want to read a book, if that's your jam, read all the books. Follow the people on social media. Even if you're like, I'm not really into social media. You know what? Like, you are now. Listen to and watch podcasts like this. You know, skip my episode, watch all the others interviewing disabled people, whatever you need to do. And you will very quickly learn exactly what you just said, that each disability presents so differently. I have a number of friends with and who have children with Down syndrome. And that is an example of something where so many presumptions are made because people think they know what Down syndrome is. Well, follow, and I'll probably mispronounce this, Chris Nisick, Nickick, and I,
Who knows?
S-I-C.
Yes.
Yes, I will get that right. We'll put it in your show notes. You know, who is this athlete and triathlete and is way more athletic than I'll ever be. I can't catch a ball, let's be honest. Follow people, even if you think you know. Follow and listen to and read autistic voices. And don't do it just to comment and like, and even if it's supportive of, oh, I'm so glad, thanks, I learned things. But put your focus on listening and reading and learning and absorbing it and taking it all in. If your goal is to serve your child, any learning you can do about disability from disabled people is serving your child.
Absolutely, absolutely. And based on that thought, sort of springboarding from that thought, what future, based on the information that you've gotten from directly from your kids, what future do you have in mind for your non-disabled child versus your disabled child? Are there any differences in
So big picture, it's interesting you should ask about future vision because at the beginning of every school year, we have this conversation, and my husband and I have it, and my children have it, for our younger son's teacher every year and for his classroom staff, we make, which this is all in the book and all the templates, and the book is a whole lot of templates and lists and worksheets so that you can just have all of this. We make a profile of here's where he is, and it has strengths, weaknesses, what I'm working on, what I love, what motivates me, what doesn't work for me. Most importantly, at the very top, the first thing under a really adorable picture and his name, we have his future vision. And it's the same future vision for both of my kids. my child will graduate from school ready for employment or further education, being an active and contributing and respected member of their community with the level of involvement that they choose. That is the vision. And I hope that's the same for both of my kids. I don't know what their paths will be. I do know that I want to raise them to have the agency to make those choices for themselves. What the choices end up being, of course, will be very different for each child. One of my children, based on his creative writing, is on track to be the next Stephen King. It's a little terrifying. Or a guitar player, and he's going to start a rock band, and it's going to be awesome. Great. The other one is so incredible. They're both social and outgoing, and I could talk about my kids all day. My other one, he will have whatever employment, community involvement, whatever it is, I am confident will be very social, very up and moving around and interacting with people. And it will very likely involve giving high fives to people, because I believe that will last well into his adulthood, because gosh, that feels good, especially coming out of COVID.
Absolutely.
Yeah, my vision is self-advocacy and self-determination for both of them. And I'd love for them to both support me in my old age, but maybe I'm getting ahead of myself.
That is a beautiful vision. Yeah, because it's based on whatever their desires will be throughout their lives as they go on their paths. Mm-hmm. Yes, being able to access all of the resources that they might need individually. Maybe some of those will be the same, maybe some of those will be different. But yes, that's beautiful.
Thank you. And also, it gives us a foundation from which to work backwards and say, okay, if my kids are going to be leading a self-determined life where they are able to make these decisions on their level of participation, independence, employment, education, all of these things, we are setting the foundation for that in elementary school. We are focusing on, for our younger son and our older son, we're focusing on loads of these things too, but for him, focusing on safety, independence, meaningful relationships, communication, because all of those things are what we believe are the building blocks to the self-determined future. Whatever that may be, I don't know what his days are going to look like 20 years from now.
Yeah.
I usually don't know what my day is going to look like 20 minutes from now. But what I do know is when every person on his team sees that future vision statement, we can start our conversations with, if this is where my son is when he graduates from high school, he's going into fourth grade. What do we need to be doing in fourth grade to place those blocks so that he gets there? And safety, independence, communication, relationships, all of those things. And those are things based on what does he show us and tell us that he loves and wants right now? It's not me saying, you know, I really like fire trucks, so let's like gear you towards that because fire trucks are awesome. Well, great. Who doesn't love fire trucks? But he is so social and so outgoing. Let's build that into the plan for families whose kids love a certain academic subject. You know what? Let's pour our energy into that and build our kids up, disabled or not. Like, let's celebrate what they love. It's fun. Fewer arguments too.
Right? Yeah. And then you get to actually experience them as individuals, their desires, their vision for their lives. Yes. And not just whatever, whatever the expectation from outside of them. Yes, absolutely. And this whole conversation, I'm reminded of what a disabled person said once. It was specifically about CP, cerebral palsy, but they said having CP, or in this case, we can say brain disability, is like having cancer. It will never affect two people the same. Right? So meaning someone can have the exact diagnosis of CP as me, and it's still completely different.
Absolutely.
And that will change throughout our lives. And at different points in our lives, we will have had other experiences that may, whatever, we will just be in a different place. And yeah, leaving it open for whatever the decision is going to be at that time. But then also, like you said, doing that future planning as much as possible to try and set things up ahead of time if they have expressed that this is something that I want to do in the future. Yeah.
Absolutely. And to speak to future planning, something that came up over and over, I have a whole chapter in the book on future and financial planning, which is a little like, whoa, like I was afraid to write this chapter because it's so overwhelming, even though we have done ours. And something that came up over and over with my experts is how often families have to be reminded to include their children in the plans. And yes, you should go back and revise your plans because if Aunt Sally is the person they would want to be their guardian at age six, well, age 16, Aunt Sally might not be an appropriate guardian anymore. But for especially for these big picture future planning and future care documents, which are gigantic, but doable. Totally doable. There are people who can help you. Involve your children in the decision-making process to the extent that they are interested and available. You might be surprised to learn that they think Aunt Sally smells funny and they don't really like being around her. If you do not ask them that, you're never going to know. So really, dig into and lean on asking your child.
Yeah. And continuing with the idea of the unknown, what is something that scares you about the future? Would you mind talking about that?
What scares me about the future? Epilepsy scares me. To be quite honest, my son, our specialist predicted he was not someone who would ever have seizures until he did. And I'm gonna cry again. That was terrifying. His seizures are largely controlled. They're in much better shape than they have been in the past. I used to sleep much better than I do now and probably will the rest of my life because I will always have one ear listening for the sounds that indicate a seizure's happening. I really hope it never comes back. But just based on medical trauma from that, and I'm certainly not saying mine is worse than my son's because he's not yet able to communicate to us his experience of epilepsy. Man, I hope that never happens again. That's scary. I think if my child expressed that he had fears about the future, then I would dig in deeper to what my fears are for him. He's awesome. Like, I know I'm a mom and that's what moms say about their kids, but like, he's great. At the moment, am I afraid for his future, for our future? Afraid isn't the right word. No, like the epilepsy, like that scares me. Let's hope it never comes back for anyone. It's hard. And it's not fear so much as inadequacy when it comes to figuring out how I am going to do the things as I get older, as he gets bigger. I can barely lift him now. He is almost as big as me. I'm real short. Because he is mobile, that makes many things easier. Because he likes to attempt to run towards moving cars in a parking lot, that makes things more difficult. Right now, I can outrun him, I can grab him, I can keep him safe. We will figure it out. I hope that he will always be able to, with whatever level support, manage himself safely, so that there is never a time when I'm not able to jump in and give him the support he needs to remain safe. Does it keep me up at night? No. I'm so focused on the present and the day to day, but is it something I think about? Yes. And how do I keep myself from fear? I talk to other families, I talk to other parents, and I talk to disabled people whenever I can. As I said before, we are reinventing these same wheels over and over. When you connect with a community, you find people who have done this before you and who can give you that information. There is so much I have no idea how to do, but I've reached a point when I've realized there's probably somebody who can help me out with this, and there's very little that I have to totally reinvent this wheel from scratch. So just find the people, do the things, love your kids, and it can be really hard. I think epilepsy is a great example of disability can be very hard. Calling 911 for seizures in the middle of the night that you can't stop at home, that's hard. That's really hard. And I always raise an eyebrow at folks and parents who are not disabled who say nothing but disability is a blessing and this is the best and I'm so glad that, like, all the things. You know what? I'm glad this is my kid. Both of my kids are fantastic. I wish we didn't have chronic medical issues that cause him pain, distress, uncertainty, medical instability, seizures, all the things. And that's hard. And there will be things in the future that catch us off guard and that are hard and that are scary. But if we don't say, like, yeah, this is hard, then I think we're setting ourselves up to just crack like an egg falling out of the carton, because I've been real close to that. And just finding community and saying, like, you know what, this is hard, it helps you keep your shit together because you don't have a choice.
Very valid, very valid. And, you know, this, you were talking about how connecting with others, connecting with disabled people, connecting with parents of disabled children as well, to maybe not have to reinvent the entire wheel,
mm-hmm,
by oneself. And yeah, and it really brings us back to, please consider getting Kelly's book, okay? Because that is, it sounds like really that's kind of part of you know, the space that that book is looking to fill for people or to support people with.
Yes, thank you.
That much needed information.
It's exciting to me that I don't ever need to write a memoir. Nobody needs to read my memoir. There are many great ones out there. But this has the personal stories. It has, every chapter has a letter from another parent. It is an intentionally diverse selection of parents in terms of ability, race, gender, LGBTQ identity, all many different things, many different disabilities of children. I leaned heavily on experts, and there is wisdom here, you know, everything from how to actually deliver a diagnosis, which is based on many years of research from a top doctor, from a home health nurse saying, here's what it's like to come into someone's home for the first time, from these incredible disability justice experts. We just need the basics so that we can figure this out and so that we can view our kid separately from all the stuff. And our kids are great. The stuff sucks. So let's do this better.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked so much good stuff. Oh, wow. But was there anything, though, that we didn't get to talk about? Anything that you wanted to share, anything that you wanted to chat about that we didn't get to get to yet?
Yeah, thank you for asking. If you don't mind me turning the tables on you, Sean, and asking you a question, I will forever be interested in discussions of language. And you said earlier that you identify yourself as a person with a disability versus a disabled person. Can you articulate why you chose that? Or is that just what is most natural for you? If you're comfortable answering.
But yeah, no, good question. So first off, as an author who's in college studying English for my major, I analyze every word so much deeper than maybe what is necessary. And it's nerdy, but you know. And so to me, saying disabled person feels like someone is saying it's all that I am. Versus being a person with a disability, which says to me, like, yes, that's part of my identity, but it's not all that I am.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying that. And as I said, it's something that I struggle with so much. And I hope that any negative connotation that unfortunately so many people have with the word disability just magically evaporates, because if we're able to use that as a word that didn't have any connotation attached to it of positive or negative, would be really exciting and necessary. So thank you for that. That's really, I'm always on a journey for my own education. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, like you said, it's individual, and then, but then also, that the point about how disabled and disability became such a bad word, or became such a word to have that connotation at all, was politically motivated and absolutely, you know,
absolutely
to harm disabled people. So it's, yeah, if that was, you know, maybe things, you know, but yeah. So thank you so much, Kelly, for coming on and having this conversation with me. And I hope that you have enjoyed it as much as I did. I really appreciate you being so open and honest and vulnerable about everything today. This is one of the reasons why this podcast, this YouTube show, whatever you want to call it, this is one of the reasons that it exists, conversations like this.
Thank you so much. Everyone should go and watch all their episodes if they haven't already. Your guests are fabulous, and so are you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you including me.
Thank you, Kelly. Absolutely. And people who aren't dealing with parenthood like you or family think it's hard. One way exists, but it's the society viewpoint that's challenging, right? So yeah, but if people wanted to connect with you, Kelly, and support the work that you do, and of course buy your book, where can they do so?
Thank you for asking. Easiest way is my website, kellycoleman.com. That's KelleyColeman.com. KelleyColeman.com has all my info and where to find me. And I am excited to be a part of your community, Sean.
But yeah, thank you, beautiful. Yes. I will make sure to share everything in my description below. Once again, I'm Sean Gold. Thank you for watching. Please make sure you like, comment all your thoughts, subscribe. Also, make sure the bell is on to be notified of each upload. And I'll see you all next time on another episode of Crippled by Culture.
Want to listen to Crippled by Culture on your favorite podcast platform? Well, now you can. Crippled by Culture is now available wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search up the show title and make sure you subscribe. Thank you for being a listener.